Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. August is here, and with it, back to school shopping.
It is looking like a really good year for retailers. They're expecting the third highest sales ever for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade, and for college kids, it's going to be the best year ever.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida has more on what retailers and consumers can expect as families get the gear their kids need for the upcoming school year. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also begin our series of candidate conversations with the lone Republican running for state auditor, James Spadola. Plus, new editions of our arts playlist and Enlighten Me. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we begin bringing you our series of candidate conversations, part of Delaware Public Media's 2018 election coverage and the Delaware debates we're producing once again this fall with the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. We've reached out to all candidates who filed to run in the U.S. House and U.S. Senate races, as well as the races for State Attorney General, State Auditor, and State Treasurer, and invited them to sit down with us at our studio on the campus of Delaware State University for an interview. Candidates in each race are being asked the same set of questions to allow you to get to know them and compare them. In addition to the interviews being aired here on The Green, the interviews will be available at DelawarePublic.org and DelawareDebates.org right through Election Day in November. We start with the race for state auditor, and specifically the one Republican running in that race, James Spadola. This is Spadola's first campaign for statewide office, but the former Newark police officer did run for state senate in 2016, losing to incumbent Democrat Harris McDowell in his North Wilmington district by a 56-44% margin. And here is our candidate conversation with James Spadola. So the first question we ask everyone is, why are you running for state auditor?
Sure. You know, when I look back at my life, I really stepped into service right after 9/11 when I enlisted in the Army because of 9/11. Had to delay my freshman year at University of Delaware, my sophomore year, because I finished basic training. We deployed to Iraq in 2003, where I did a year-long tour, and been in various community service efforts since, which we can get into. But so first and foremost, I have a very strong belief in service. And with the auditor's race specifically, acting as the fiscal watchdog is such an important role. And considering Delaware is such a one-party state, it is super important that this seat stay in the hands of the minority party. If you have one group creating all the programs, does it make sense for that same group to be monitoring them for fraud and waste? I don't think so. I think you need somebody from the minority party, because otherwise it's the fox guarding the hen house. And when you look at my background, my first job was in Manhattan working in finance, where I supervised a team where we put out millions of dollars on the street. I was a police officer, so I have the investigative background. I have my MBA from Wilmington University. I was my union treasurer as a police officer. So I've got a good blend of financial acumen along with the investigative skills to help lead and manage the auditor's office.
You just talked a little bit about your background, but what else in your background, or if you want to elaborate a little bit more, do you feel makes you better suited for this job than the other candidates you're running against?
Sure. So I don't think any of them really have the blend of the experience that I have. The job of the state auditor, it's more of a when you speak with people who have worked there, the auditor him or herself is not in there crunching numbers, interviewing people. It's more of a visionary role. It's a relationship building role, and especially when you look at my work as a Newark police officer, where I had the viral video walking down mm-hmm. Main Street, giving out free hugs, set up so many community building programs there, some of which still continue. It's super important that the auditor speaks with other cabinet heads and builds that relationship so they know that the auditor's office is not the enemy and that we can work together to reduce the fraud and waste of taxpayer dollars.
You mentioned the word vision. What are your priorities and vision for the state auditor's office?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, staffing is a persistent issue there. We need to get more auditors in. We need to train them. We need to work on their professional development so we can retain them. I think, you know, we just saw David Benz pass a bill for loan forgiveness for teachers that are in high needs schools. I think that's something that could be considered for the auditor's office. In terms of the actual function, so I'm in Leadership Delaware this year, which is just a fantastic deep dive into the workings of Delaware government and the business and nonprofit community as well. And Melanie George Smith, one of the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee, she spoke and she mentioned how part-time legislators, when they are writing the budget, reviewing the budget, they don't have the – they only look at the marginal change from the governor's proposed budget year over year. So basically, every time the governor proposes a budget, that's what the JFC looks at. They only compare it the year over year. And a cabinet secretary is not going to come in and say, you know what, the governor did this wrong. You know, somebody appointed by the governor is not going to say the governor was wrong. We actually need X amount of dollars instead of Y. And the part-time legislators, and this is not a knock on them, it's just the nature of the beast, they don't have the time to go into that agency and say, you know what, maybe we can trim down on some savings. There's some potential for savings here. Whereas I think there could be a deeper relationship with the auditor's office, and I think it falls under the umbrella of investigating fraud, waste, and abuse of taxpayer dollars to have that deeper collaboration. Another thing I think we should do is with the grant and aid bill. You know, we need to work with the nonprofit community to make sure that our taxpayer dollars are getting the best outcomes, and we can do that by developing metrics in accordance with them to make sure that the most efficient nonprofits are getting funded, and maybe even more funding if at the expense of the nonprofits that are not meeting their metrics that are set. But right now, that's just not being done. We're putting out, I think the grant and aid bill that passed was $45 million or so every year. Yeah. You know, there's no accountability for those taxpayer dollars.
You mentioned staffing. The next question we ask is about current staffing at the auditor's office and if you think it's adequate. It sounded like you were saying you didn't think so. Do you have a sense of where that staffing should be?
Well, when Tom Wagner came into office, there were 57 auditors. Now there's 20. And surely you can attribute some of that attrition to technology and whatnot. But I think we need, you know, if you look at the smoke covering the auditor's office with management leaving, one of the candidates leaving, getting fired. And I'm not going to comment on any personnel issues, but I think we need to start with management there and make sure that, you know, the vision is shared collectively with the new auditor. And then you bring on the entry level auditors to help implement that vision. So I don't have a magic number, but I think it starts with the management team, and then you work down bringing on some more additional auditors.
Because of the nature of the auditor's office work, should the office actively work to distance itself from politics and party ties, and if so, how?
The office needs to be independent, and I think it's this exactly why it's so important for a member of the minority party to hold that, if not somebody who runs as an independent. You know, a key component of auditing is the segregation of duties. Sometimes you require two people to sign a check to prevent fraud. It's no different than having the minority party in charge of the auditor's office. There's just too much potential for, backroom deals and shoving things under the carpet when one party is creating the programs, monitoring them, and then writing about the fraud that did or didn't take place in there. So I think it's super important that we maintain the independence of it. And there's only one Republican candidate, and that's me. And, you know, another thing with the office, it's not an ideological or partisan position in the sense that we're not allocating funds for Planned Parenthood. We're not talking about the Second Amendment. So whether you love Trump or hate him, the vote for the auditor's office is totally irrelevant to all of that. It's all about checks and balances.
Does the work of the auditor's office need to be made more visible to the public? Does the public know enough about what the auditor's office is doing or should be doing?
My hunch is no. You know, from campaigning, most people don't know what the auditor's office does. And it's a fairly simple explanation. You investigate fraud, waste, and abuse of taxpayer dollars, sit on a few committees, most probably the Board of Pardons being one of the most, you know, something that would, my law enforcement background would definitely help with that. But no, I think, you know, the public, you know, I don't think the auditor's office has a Facebook page right now, you know, and I think, so I think there needs to be a PR a component to the auditor's office to putting the, to getting the message out. And, you know, like for any government employee, they know DTI, the, I forget what it stands for, but it's the tech center for, for the Delaware government. They send out email blasts all the time across all state. You know, when I was in Newark Cop, DTI would email us all the time about be careful of this fraudulent, you know, spam email. There's no reason that the auditor's office shouldn't be putting out emails, you know, informing whistleblowers of their rights or saying, hey, if you're seeing anything unethical, here is a independent, here's a way to report that without fear of retribution. So I think there's, you know, there's a public relations mission that needs to come along with the next state auditor, and it's definitely a multifaceted approach.
You alluded a little bit earlier to kind of relationships with the legislature and things like that. So that kind of plays into this next question, which is, does the auditor's office have an appropriate role in influencing state policy in areas beyond simply the accountability and state finances, or should the auditor solely be a watchdog?
You know, I don't think – I think it's important to have a presence at Legislative Hall so the legislators know you and so they're not – they know what you do. And with me, they know that I'm not a partisan. You know, I'm a moderate guy in a lot of different ways, somebody who, you know, deeply cares about people. And so they know that, you know, if I come to their office with an audit or if I'm auditing one of their programs, they know that, okay, Spadola's going to be super fair about this. Let's work together and take it from there. But so, no, I think the answer to your question, would I be pushing legislation? If that's the question, I don't think that's the role of the auditor's office.
Okay. And is there an issue or area or issues or areas you think need to be investigated or better scrutinized right now?
I think I alluded to the grant and aid bill, along with the you know, the agencies. There's just not the deep dive done year over year. And, you know, I think, is it feasible every year to assign an auditor for 6 months to investigate the Secretary of the Department of Education? I don't think that's feasible. But every 4 years or so, I think that's a lot more realistic, and I think that's a good starting point.
Our thanks to Republican candidate for State Auditor James Spadola for his time on Candidate Conversations. Next week on The Green, we'll hear from the three Democrats running for State Auditor. And up next on this week's edition of The Green, back-to-school shopping season is underway, and we'll hear from contributor Eileen Dalabrida about what both consumers and retailers can expect. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. It's hard to believe, but as the calendar turns to August, summer vacation is heading into the home stretch, and mom and dad need to start thinking about getting the gear their kids need for the upcoming school year. Yes, it's back-to-school shopping season, and each summer we check in with Delaware Public Media contributor Eileen Dalabrida to learn more about what's going on with this year's back-to-school retail trends. Her piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and she joins us now to talk about what she found. Eileen, thanks for being with us on The Green this week.
It's good to be here, Tom.
So let's start with what the outlook is for back-to-school sales this year. What is it looking like? At least what do the experts say?
It is looking like a really good year for retailers. They're expecting the third highest sales ever for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade, and for college kids, it's going to be the best year ever.
And where is the bulk of that money going, according to the experts?
Most of the money this year is going for clothes, which I think is very interesting. It has passed electronics, and so we're looking at $236 for clothing, not including shoes. We're expected to spend an extra $138 for shoes, compared to a total of $187 for electronics.
And I found it interesting that you noted that electronics are not as big a slice of the pie as before. Is there a sense of why that is? Why, you know, these big ticket items that used to be kind of a big deal as you were getting ready to go back to school are maybe not as much this year?
Well, I think it's because we have been buying those things all along. It's not that we're like, oh my goodness, it's time to go back to school. Let's go get a laptop. We might have bought that 6 months ago.
And you mentioned the clothing being a big piece. Is it fair to reasonable to think that that's why the college kids are a little bit more expensive than the K to 12 kids? Because maybe more clothes, more expensive clothes?
More clothes, more expensive clothes, and also outfitting the dorm room, outfitting the apartment. So kids who aren't in college don't buy coffee makers, but kids do need those kinds of things for their all-nighters. They're buying microwaves. They're buying fridges. They're buying all kinds of linens, things like that. And it's just a whole extra layer of expense.
I was going to say, that does seem to add up. In years past, you've noted that unlike many other retail areas, back to school still seems to be something of an in-store rather than online experience for most people. Is that still true, or is it slowly starting to migrate more online now?
It is very strongly an in-store experience, and that is partly because of the efforts of merchants to drive people to stores. It's like you order it online, go pick it up in the store, and hopefully while you're there, you'll buy something else. And also, I think that it's something that truly is a family event, that kids have been home all summer, they're getting ready to go back to school. This is an opportunity for parents and kids to interact. And it's also a teachable moment about budgeting. You know, not that long ago, we had a really difficult economy. And I think that it was one of those times when, you know, parents had those kinds of discussions about where do we spend our money, and that those kinds of discussions still go on.
And you mentioned the idea of retailers trying to push people to the store. There's no doubt that tech's becoming a bigger part of this back-to-school shopping experience, even if you are going to a store. How are retailers and shoppers finding a way to incorporate their tech, even as they're actually physically going to a brick-and-mortar establishment?
Well, you can. The techs will tell you what is a promotion today, or sometimes it's a discount, and that will spur you to go to the store. And also, I think that, you know, having our phones to call up and say, look, I'm here at Best Buy, but I see this for less money at Bed Bath & Beyond. Will you match it? Hold up your phone and they'll say, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess also, you know, a lot of the store's apps are trying to, you know, be part of that experience. I mean, they make it a little bit more easier for you to find their deals, or as you said, to get coupon or extra percent off. And I guess even, you know, they allow you to tie into your school's school supply list anymore.
Yes, you can go to your school, pull up the school's list, and some stores, including Walmart, will actually direct you to the item on the shelf. So they make it very easy for us to spend money.
I was going to say, you don't have to put together that whole list. You just have to bring your phone with you and be told where to go, which is kind of a different experience than I'm sure, you know, most parents remember.
I think so. And I think that we understand that people's time is valuable. So it's, here's the best price. Here's where it is. We have it in stock. Go to town.
And whether people are shopping online or in store, Eileen, you know, the competition for their dollars clearly is fierce. What are some of the retailers doing to get their fair share? You kind of alluded to some of these efforts to, you know, just kind of hit people with deals, maybe that they're not even asking for.
The deals are really, really super. At Walmart, you can get an Elmer's glue stick for 50 cents. You can get 24 Crayola crayons for 50 cents, $8 jeans at Target, $4 t-shirts. JCPenney has a lot of 50% off sales on back to school. And they have, Kohl's has some good deal on attractive name brands, 25% off on Adidas and Converse. The deals are out there, and they're very competitive.
And I guess the question then becomes, we talk about this when we talk about Christmas shopping and other big retail times. Is there a benefit to waiting? Is there a benefit to procrastinating? Do the deals get better? Or does it really not matter whether you're first in line or you know, doing things last minute?
Well, if the retailers had their way, we would all be done in July. And there's a good reason for that, because people who shop early tend to spend more. They tend to keep shopping. And they spend an average of $100 more per family on back-to-school shopping. But you don't need everything on the first day of school. And if you do wait, you are going to get a better deal. When things start clear, they mark it down and clear it out. So if you do wait until after school starts to get the things that you absolutely positively don't have to have, you're going to save yourself some money.
And I guess that really, you know, in some regards for the retailers, I mean, they do have kind of a built-in early shopper, and that's usually the college kids, right? Because they've got to get all their stuff presumably before they leave. It's the K through 12 families that have the opportunity to wait and, as you said, maybe buy something after school starts.
Yes, although there are programs where you can shop for your college kid and then have it shipped to school after school starts, so that you don't have to lug everything down there, that you can just pick it up in a local store. But we're not seeing them waiting like the K through 12 set.
And I guess the other question I have for you is, because I think you mentioned this in your article, I mean, are retailers, you know, because of the way things are now, kind of this hybrid between online and in-store shopping, do they still need extra actual physical bodies, you know, for this type of back-to-school shopping season, or is that something that's a thing of the past, hiring additional people?
They do, and Kohl's has been very heavy on hiring more than 1,000 stores, plus they are keeping those folks on through the winter holiday shopping. They'll be in the stores until after Christmas, which I see as a very positive sign for the economy, that people are buying and that they anticipate that they will continue to buy for some months to come.
Yeah, and I guess the Christmas shopping season probably begins not long after the back-to-school shopping season anymore.
It will be with us before Halloween.
Eileen Dalabrito, we really do appreciate it. And your piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org if people want to get a little bit more on back-to-school shopping and what they can find in terms of trends and deals. Eileen, thanks for being with us on The Green this week.
Thanks, Tom.
And stay with us. The Green continues in just a couple of moments with our latest edition of the Arts Playlist. But first, we have a look at your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A customer relations and communications manager for Delaware's Department of Transportation is getting a chance to show off her work as a photographer starting this weekend in New Castle County. Shelley Kuhn describes herself as an urban explorer and photographer with a deep love of abandoned structures. Wither, Exploration of the Forgotten, is the name of her exhibit on display all this month at the Mezzanine Gallery, located on the second floor of the Carvel State Building in Wilmington. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Kuhn about her photographs and the exhibit.
Tell me a little bit, if you will, Shelley, about your artistry, your photographs.
What I primarily photograph these days is abandoned structures. I started off years ago doing a lot of portrait work, kind of got out of it. And then I moved to the East Coast and started noticing just a lot of old factories and old structures that kind of run up and down the coast. And then I found a gentleman online who did some workshops in old factories. And I thought, gee, that looks like a lot of fun. So started going to the workshops and just really fell in love with these old structures.
Okay, so you work for DelDOT, but you're also a local photographer. When did you get into photography?
Oh my gosh, I was 7 years old. We were over at a relative's house, and I happened to find one of those old plastic box cameras and fell in love with it. And my aunt was like, oh sure, I'm not using it, take it. And I went out and took the worst possible photographs for, you know, like 2 years straight.
Now, we're not talking the old-timey cameras where you put the thing over your head. We're not talking that kind of camera, are
we? No, it was like almost like a little plastic box. It's so funny because I can remember exactly what it looked like. That's how attached it was to me. It was mint green, made of plastic, had a little green plastic strap, and I would just follow my friends around and photograph them, which horrified my parents because that meant I had all of this film that had to be developed, which cost, and so, you know, they were trying to slow me down a little bit. But going through high school, I ended up taking photography. Later on, I went back to college, took more photography, got out of it a little while, had a son, raised him, but got back into it eventually. And when I moved to the East Coast, I found I had a lot of extra time on my hands and decided to make the jump into digital. And it's like the best thing I ever did because with digital, there's no cost to develop anything. So you can just, you know, photograph all day long.
The reason we're talking to Shelley Kuhn today is because her photographs, some of them, are going to be on view in the Mezzanine Gallery. Talk about that. How exciting.
I am super excited. This is the first solo exhibit I've ever done. I've been in group shows in the past. And I was so excited. I almost missed the email. It was terrible. I had been traveling. And you know how it is when you're traveling, you get a lot of email that you kind of like, oh, I'm going to put that later. I'm going to read it later.
Yep.
And happened to pull up, and I was like, I really need to go through this. It had probably been a week and a half, 2 weeks since they had sent me the email. And I immediately dropped everything and was like, yes, I am interested. Luckily, they had not filled the spot. So it's been a lot of work. I've never put together an entire show by myself. It's been a great learning experience. I have to say that everybody up at the Division of the Arts in Delaware have been amazing through this entire process in helping get it together. I've had a lot of friends who've come in and helped. I put together an Indiegogo campaign to help offset some of the cost because it's quite expensive to put these shows together.
Sure.
That was a completely new experience for me. And it actually got picked up by Cater's news agency. So it ended up on MSN.com and Yahoo.com. And I had a lot of people reach out to me. So the entire experience, I mean, there's the excitement of having my work up so that people can see it. But there's also the excitement of it actually kind of went worldwide. And
wow.
I've had a lot of people reach out to me and say, hey, these buildings are great. I've had people reach out to me and say, you know, you need to come to my neighborhood because we have this old factory that you should photograph.
All right. So tell me the name of the exhibit. And you touched base when we started the conversation a little bit. I think you have described yourself as an urban explorer and photographer who has a deep love of abandoned structures. But tell me the name of the exhibit and then talk about that again. Why abandoned structures?
So the name of the exhibit is Wither, Exploration of the Forgotten. And why abandoned structures? There's just something very beautiful about them to me. And, you know, my husband doesn't get it at all. He goes, that's an old building. He said, you hang out in old creepy places, Shelley. But there's something really beautiful about these buildings. And when nature starts to take these buildings back, especially these factories, you see this very softness of nature. You see the plants growing back through. You see the moss growing on things. And then you see these big I-beams, these metal I-beams. And there's such a juxtaposition between the two. The colorings in the building is beautiful. When you're in an older structure, there's a lot of dust in them. And anytime light comes through dust, it does fantastic things with the light. When you see beautiful sunsets, what you're actually seeing is all of the light coming through all of these dust particles, and that's what makes them so gorgeous. So on a little bit of a smaller scale, that's kind of what I see in these old buildings.
Yeah, and very good lines, too, I can imagine.
Yes, amazing lines. And I come from the world of graphic design as well. I was an art director for 20 years and did a lot of work in graphic design and layout. And that kind of translates over into the photography because there are those lines, again, that I love.
Talk to me about your background a little bit. You're not from Delaware, right?
I am not from Delaware. I was actually born in Illinois, but I moved to California when I was 18, and I lived there for over 35 years, which I'm told makes me a native of California. I have a son. He still actually lives in California, so still have ties, go back and forth.
So Wither, Exploration of the Forgotten, a photography exhibit by you, Shelley Kuhn, is going to be on view in the Mezzanine Gallery starting tonight through August 31st. You're going to be hosting a free opening reception as well tonight, correct?
Yes, I am. I am going to be there from 5 o'clock till 7 p.m., I keep telling all my friends there's wine, beer, and cupcakes.
That well, what more everything. Could you want than right? Wine, beer, and cupcakes?
I know my friends well.
Man, I might have to come just because of the wine, beer, and cupcakes. Nothing to do with your photography, of course.
Right, right. That's what I keep telling people. I'm like, if old buildings aren't your thing, I will feed you and give you drink.
Old buildings, not wine, beer, cupcakes, definitely.
Yeah, exactly.
That's too funny. So everybody, can anybody come to this exhibition during the time that it's being put on view in the Mezzanine Gallery? And is tonight's reception free?
Absolutely, to both. I would love to have people come out and see the exhibit, not just for the photography, but kind of to take a look at these buildings and understand what's happening with a lot of these abandoned structures. And one of the things that I like to talk about, and I'll talk about that night too, is some of the structures can be saved and some of them can't. And it's an education process. And I really like to help educate people about the buildings, what makes them salvageable and what makes them things that just can't. I have a lot of friends who are like, oh, it's so horrible. They're going to tear that building down. Why can't they save it? And the answer to that is it's gone too far. The weather has taken its toll on it, or it has chemicals in it that need to be cleaned out that are just too costly. Whereas other structures can be saved. And sometimes I really think we need to try to save these structures, and we can because of the craftsmanship involved in making them. They're just gorgeous.
All right. So, Shelley, if people can't make it out tonight to the opening reception, or they can't make it out throughout the entire month when your photography is on exhibit, do you have a website that you can direct people to view some of your work?
I do. I actually have two websites. Is it okay if I give them both?
You can.
Okay.
For some beer, wine, and cupcakes, of course.
Right? and I'm always up for that. If you happen to see me out and you want to take me out for beer, wine, and cupcakes, I'm totally on board for
well,
that.
I was hoping it was the other way around. I was hoping you were giving the beer, wine, and cupcakes.
on August 3rd, I will. Other than that, we have to negotiate.
Okay. Tell me where I can view your photography.
So my work can be found at shelleykuhn.com, and that's S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-O-O-N. That is where I put a lot of my art stuff, but I'm also starting to migrate over to my new site, which is a business site. That site is 68huntley.com, and it's 68huntley.com.
Is that a significant address? Is that your address or something? Or
it is. It's actually the first house I ever bought in Delaware.
Wow.
And I'm excited about it. It's a great property. I think as a photographer, it kind of spoke to me because there's a lot of bits on the property that can be used in photography. I love urbex photography. I love photographing abandoned buildings. But what I have started doing is bringing people into these spaces and photographing them, doing their portraits in just kind of these ruins. And I get it's the juxtaposition of life and kind of the death of the building that I think is just kind of romantic in some ways. I know that sounds weird, but...
Thanks to photographer Shelley Kuhn and our Kelly Steele for bringing us this week's Arts Playlist. And again, in addition to the exhibition at the Carvel State Building's Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington, two websites where you can view Kuhn's photography are kellykuhn.com and 68huntley.com. And we'll wrap up this week's edition of The Green next with our Enlighten Me segment. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Last weekend was the 24th annual People's Festival in Wilmington. It's a tribute to reggae legend Bob Marley, who lived in the city at times during the 1960s and 70s. And this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with festival co-founder Jenny Pitts about the festival's humble origins and her friendship with the Marley family.
Jenny Pitts has been organizing the People's Festival, an annual tribute to Bob Marley in Wilmington, for 24 years. But the festival wasn't even her idea. She's the first to tell you she's no particular expert on reggae music. And she's not even a huge fan. But Pitts is a fan of Bob Marley, who lived in Wilmington on and off in the 60s and 70s. The two were personal friends. And she describes his mother, Sadella Marley Booker, as like a second mother to her. The musical tribute to Marley in Wilmington was Booker's idea.
She was at our home for a visit, and we had a big celebration for her. And she just made an announcement in her gratitude and thank you all for coming and all. She said, the next time I see you all, we'll be in Wilmington, Delaware, where Jenny and Ibis are going to do a tribute to Bob.
This was news to Pitts, but she decided to take on the challenge. The connection between Pitts and the Marley family started with Pitts' husband, Ibis, when he ran an African import store in Wilmington.
Rita Marley was the first point of contact because she strolled into his shop, and he used to love to tell this story because he said she was a real petite woman with this kinky, nappy hair, and it was just wild. You know, it was just wild. And so, you know, it was kind of unique to see a young sister looking like that. And then she strolled into his shop barefooted. So here comes this little beautiful lady, and he had music playing. So she was dancing to the music, and he found that interesting. So they got to talking. She talked about Bob and how he was a musician. And then the next time he comes in town, I'm going to bring him to meet you. And then she brought him to meet, and that's how they met. And the three of them became friends. I mean, instantly, they were all artists and they loved, you know, that vibe.
That was before Bob Marley was famous. Jenny Pitts met him a few years later in California when his music career was starting to take off.
And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app.
My husband and
we'd
I
also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas
and
on our Facebook page,
on
Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.
And, you know, nothing was happening. In 1969. So this was in 1974. So that quickly, Bob was at the Roxy. So we went back to of course, my husband threw everything we had at the beach in the car and hightailed it. And I'm saying, what's going on? What do we do? He said, Bob Marley, Bob Marley. And so we got there, and then the marquee said, sold out concert. And there were people everywhere. The line was around the building, and I was like, what in the world? So he got out of the car. I said, where are you going? He said, I'm going to go find Bob. And in my head, I'm thinking, yeah, right, you know. But he was back in the jiffy, like 15 minutes he was back, and he said, come on. And I said, now where are we going? We're going to go see Bob. He's backstage. So he maneuvered his way backstage. We ended up back there with Bob and the crew, and that whole weekend was just amazing. And that's where the whole friendship started. We just became friends.
Then in 1994, more than a decade after Marley died of cancer, Pitts jumped in with both feet to honor him with a tribute festival.
That first year was totally incredible because I knew nothing about what it meant. When Mother B said we were going to do a tribute to Bob, the only image I got was we used to tour with the family and manage the merchandise. We managed merchandise on a tour in the U.S., and then I also went to Mexico with them. So when she said a tribute to Bob, all I could imagine was one of these big, huge concerts I had been to that were just music concerts, and I thought, oh, my God. And not knowing anything about anything to do with production, I went to cultural affairs. So they couldn't help us financially, but I was in their office every day, and they remember this, and they laugh at me all the time still because I was like a thorn in their side. Okay, now what do I do? Okay, now what do I do, you know? So while they didn't help with money, they certainly helped with, you know, giving me the nuts and bolts, and the rest was up to me. So my husband and I just took it from that point, and we booked a stage. We knew that, at least I knew, that it wasn't going to be no backyard thing with a trailer pulling up for the stage, you know? This was a tribute to Bob, and it had to be done in top-notch style because we had to set the precedent. You know, you can't do a tribute to Bob, you know, on a trailer. So we went to the most prestigious staging company there in Wilmington, and the sound company, and I knew that as long as the stage and the sound were top notch, then the rest of the festival would fall together. And that's exactly what happened. We sought out vendors because we were vendors, so we kind of knew what that vendor world looked like. So we got some food vendors, some craft vendors, and did everything, if you can imagine, doing something, not having any idea what the ending result will be or how it's going to, you know, we just plugged in whatever we knew being told what had to be plugged in to make it happen. And so people would ask, you know, so how many people do you expect or what? And I said, you know, I expect my family, my husband, myself, and my six kids. And anything beyond that is going to be gravy because that's all I have control over. So that's who's going to be there for sure. And it was amazing. It was so amazing. All year, from the time I started planning it and the word got out, I had bands calling me from all sides. Back in 94, when we were doing the planning, there wasn't anything of this magnitude that had been produced. Yes, there were tributes to Bob or a reggae show here and there in Philly or whatever, but something that was being put out there as tribute to Bob, main stage kind of thing, not in the park with a little stage and no bit of production, was new. So the bands were calling, and I felt that I was obligated to tell them, yes, of course, you can pay tribute to Bob. And all I knew is that they would each say, I just want to do two songs, 15 minutes. So I scheduled like that. Okay, 15 minutes this guy, the next 15 minutes that guy. I didn't leave room for the middle part, like breakdown and setup. So I booked 22 bands, and the show was supposed to be from noon to 8. And Richie Havens, Damian Marley, and a few other artists were all coming, and I just assumed that I had two stages, so I said, there won't be a minute lost. One stage goes off, the next one goes on. So yes, 22 bands, you know. So in those days, the police were a lot more flexible. So in the evening, as the night progressed, we could see that there's no way we're going to end at 8. You know, there's still six more bands, and we're already at 9 o'clock or whatever, you know. So Richie Havens was the headliner, and I kept having to apologize because it was 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and so on, and it still was not his turn. He was supposed to go on at 7 p.m., Richie Havens came on stage at 12:30 at night. And the first thing he said on stage was, this is very reminiscent of Woodstock. And that's all the crowd needed. They just fell out.
The music went on until 1:30 at night. Pitt still finds it hard to believe she was able to get so many musicians on board that first year.
A lot of the bands did play in kind because, like I said, they were calling to say, we want to help pay tribute on that day. So I would tell them, I said, well, we don't have any money. And they said, no, we just want to play two songs. We just want to get, you know, do our tribute. And so I felt so obligated to say, great, okay, you know, you can come pay tribute, you know. So the funding came from my husband and I. We really went out on a limb and did that, and it was very costly. The city of Wilmington had 35 policemen that they told us were required, because this was new to them too, and you know, I guess they didn't know what to expect, so they booked like 30 to 35 police officers. It was a huge amount. We've never had that number again, thank God. But in that year, you know, they were kind of testing the waters, and so that's what happened. So the bill was astronomical, and yes, my husband and I paid that bill. We charged $15 to get in, which was nothing compared to the cost involved, you know. But I wanted to make it free if possible, because it was a tribute to Bob, and I didn't want anybody to have to stay outside the walls if we could at all help it. So I went from $15 to come in. Instead of increasing that, we started charging $7 so people could come to the tribute.
And last weekend, thanks to a new partnership with Live Nation, the People's Festival was free for the first time. I asked Pitts why the memory of Bob Marley has inspired so many people to volunteer for the tribute or to travel to Wilmington to honor him. She says it was his message of unity and love and the way he spoke about a higher power.
Just sitting in the room the last time that Bob and I were together, I remember he was doing an interview and there were so many people in the room, and I just kind of slid down the wall and sat on, you know, sat on the floor and was just listening. And that, I'll never forget that evening, because although that was the last time that I was in the room while he did that, it was a time that really I was inspired to go and kiss his feet, because to me at that moment he was revealed as a saint, truly. And that's very personal to me. I don't share that story with people because a lot of people wouldn't understand that. And I don't understand it because I don't get jittery with fame, you know, and, oh, there's so-and-so. I don't do that. So when I tell you that it affected me like that, it affected me like that from inside out, not from outside in. Hmm. And so, you know, if you ever hear somebody tell you the truth from the core out, it's just different.
That's Jenny Pitts, co-founder of the annual People's Festival in Wilmington. And I'm Sophia Schmidt for Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to Jenny Pitts and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us on The Green this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.